Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second. The following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
He's an American icon who fought in World War II, gave you Martin and Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704, Hauser, Channel 11 and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. What you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
We're good to go. So when the man says we're good to go, we are all of the above.
Yeah.
All of the above is the title with Norman Lear and Paul Hipp. And it's H-I-P-P. It's a very difficult word to spell.
Good afternoon, Norman.
Good afternoon, Paul. And we're expecting a friend of yours, who a wonderful actor,
yeah,
that whose work I know, but who I have never met,
Johnny C. McGinley.
Johnny C. McGinley,
great actor from all the way back, the Oliver Stone films. People forget because he's had such success in other things that he started out with Oliver Stone. That's a nice way to start out.
Yeah,
right? Platoon. I got a bad feeling about the Platoon. Great Platoon, Wall Street. And then flash forward to Scrubs, a lot of films and stuff in there, but
very unique Oliver Stone.
Yeah,
that,
very unique.
That body of work is very unique work.
Yeah, John's got some interesting insights in that because he worked with him so much. I actually helped him cast. In fact, he has a great, I'll let him tell it, but he has a great thing about when an actor walks in. This reminded me of, you had this, you've described this times a billion when Carol O'Connor walked in.
Uh-huh.
And Red Archie.
Oh,
John's
God.
Got a take on this because he helped Oliver with some casting.
Right.
And so he has a take that was really eye-opening for me and for young actors about when somebody walks in and owns the role. But we'll let him. And he's here.
John C. McGinley is here?
He is here.
All of the Above with Norman Lear.
Happy birthday to us. Happy birthday to us. That's right. The Lady Aang podcast is turning 100. We have laughed, cried, giggled, unfiltered through 100 episodes, and we want you to join us for our 100th birthday extravaganza. We're looking back at all the best moments, the funniest moments, the best advice we got from our 100 guests, and we want you to join us. So come find us on Tuesday, and you can find us exclusively at podcastone.com or the new Podcast One app. And don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts so we can feel famous.
Now back to All of the Above with Norman Lear.
My God.
He's coming in the room.
He is entering the room even as
good
we
afternoon,
speak.
Gentlemen.
Hello, John C.
Oh, I'm in good voice today.
You are very resonant.
How are you, John C.?
I'm firm.
Firm?
Yes.
Yeah, do you work out? Because you look very...
No, a lot of stress.
Yeah, that's all stress muscle?
Yeah, I think the most underrated diet on the planet is the stress diet.
You did one of the great things of all time, which is, I just did this in reverse. You lost weight for a role, you were telling me. Drank nothing but green juice for months, and you lost most of your body weight, and then did the movie, achieved the skinny, you know, did your De Niro thing, right? And then what happened?
The movie sucked.
And nobody...
It broke my heart.
What was the movie?
It was called Highway. At first, it was called a Leonard Cohen Afterworld, which is a Kurt Cobain lyric, but Courtney Love wouldn't let the producers have it for anything. And so it was sanitized into this horrible title, Highway. And the film didn't work because it was a road movie about four different individuals getting in one car and going to Kurt Cobain's funeral. And so just like in The Wizard of Oz, we need everybody to be tone-wise in the same frequency. And they weren't. Jared Leto was in one movie. Jake Gyllenhaal was in another movie. Selma Blair was in one movie. And I was here, skinny guy with dreads sewn into my scalp.
And who was directing all those movies?
Nobody.
Maybe that's a problem. But I just love that you did the famous thing that every actor dreams of, the De Niro thing of transforming your body. But nobody ever tells you, oh, by the way, there's a chance no one will see this movie.
Right. Yeah. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I was recently, I was putting on weight for a film.
I'm sorry?
I was putting on weight, just eating and
that's
eating.
That's interesting.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And then the funding fell through.
So this is Norman Lear. I'm sitting with two actors. Now, I have been with actors all my life, it would seem to me, and I am, what is the best word? I am awed by great acting, just awed by people who can pick up a character that may be totally foreign to them and become that person, like Carol O'Connor as Archie Bunker.
Yeah,
this Irish intellectual, and I do mean Irish, and I do mean intellectual, well-spoken, kind, dear, you know, a scholarly person suddenly becomes Archie Bunker. Fucking amazing.
Yeah.
And so I'm sitting with two guys who know how to do, who spend their lives doing that, and it knocks me out. Tell us about our guest McGinley.
Johnny C. Well, Johnny C and I, we're buddies going back. We did a movie. We actually did a movie. We didn't know each other. We did Fathers and Sons with Jeff Goldblum.
Right.
Going way back. But Johnny C is, well, you tell us, Johnny, out of NYU, right?
I got out of NYU in 1984 in the grad program, and about 2 months before I got out, I wasn't allowed to, but I auditioned to understudy John Turturro in a John Patrick Shanley play called Danny in the Deep Blue Sea. And it's a two-hander with was John and June Stein. And John had the same work ethic as Lou Gehrig and the Wally Pipp syndrome.
Gene Stein, did you say?
No, June Stein.
Oh, June Stein.
And so it was just a 88-minute play, a one-act. It was a hurricane. And John just wouldn't go down. And I used to have to put I was also the assistant stage manager as well as his understudy. And I used to have to put prosthetics on his hand, on the character Danny's hand. And then I didn't call the lights, but I did shut the house down. And it was at Circle in the Square on Bleecker. So it was maybe 170 seats. I doubt it.
Right.
And so John finally went to do the film we all auditioned for, but nobody got, Desperately Seeking Susan, which was the big deal at the time.
Yeah.
Every New York actor in the planet, and Madonna was famously in it. And John went to do it for a weekend, and I finally got to go on for him. And when you're doing an off-Broadway play, you do two Friday nights, two Saturday, one Sunday. So you do five shows in about 36 hours. And during one of those shows, somebody came down from Oliver Stone's group, who were then casting Platoon, to see John, but they saw me. And then they invited me up to audition. I got a role in the film, and then the film was canceled for 2 years. And then when it was reconstituted and moved from Mexico to the Philippines, I got to play the fourth lead because John Spencer, rest in peace, went up to Broadway to do an Emily Mann play about Harvey Milk called Execution of Justice. And so I got to play the fourth lead in this movie, this low-budget independent film. And when it was reconstituted, I was playing third guy on the left in Hamlet, Kevin Kline's Hamlet at the Public. And I was playing seven guys, but it didn't matter. It was Kevin's big Hamlet. And they brought in a fancy director from Minneapolis, Live Chule, and a Hungarian director.
It's a fancy name.
Yeah, very fancy. And so we were about 2 weeks in rehearsal, and I was understudying Laertes as well as playing these other guys. So we were 2 weeks in with B.H. Barry, who was the famous sword fight instructor guy. And so we're 2 weeks into fights, and Oliver Stone calls me up, and he says, McGinley, do you want to play the fourth lead in my fucking movie? And I said, well, I would love to, but I'm doing Hamlet at the Public. And just like with Johnny Friendly in On the Waterfront, no one would dare burn the Joe Papp Bridge.
Right, yeah.
Once you got in that fraternity slash sorority, you were in, and Rosemary Tischler would just place you in different things. That was the casting person. And so I was well into the fraternity. I was doing, you know, covering Laertes and playing seven different roles and just essentially mopping the floor. But it was great. It was Kevin's frickin' Hamlet.
Yeah, man of the theater.
So Oliver insisted, and so he goes, just go tell Joe. Like, I'm going to call Mr. Papp Joe. And so he goes, just go tell Joe that I need you. And so I said, I did. And I went in to see Mr. Papp, who always had a burner, and it was this guy. It was way in here. And he just said, and he called me Mac. He goes, Mac, come on in. What can I do for you? And I said, I'm talking to Joe Papp. And they said, Oliver Stone's offered me a lead in a big fat movie. And he goes, well, you go ahead. We'll do another play when you get back.
And nice.
I almost started weeping because he was not busting my chaps. And so I withdrew from Hamlet. And then there was a revolution in the Philippines. And I was living in a funeral parlor at the time. And I sat in the funeral parlor for 6 months waiting for the revolution to end. And the play opened. And Vincent Canby called it the most important Hamlet on these shores. And
wow.
I wasn't in it.
Oh.
And you were.
I'm watching the Philippines, and this is right when Imelda Marcos's shoes became the stuff of late night fodder. When she was, they were given. What do you call it? In Hawaii, they moved to Hawaii, but he wouldn't leave.
Can I tell you my Joe Papp story?
Yeah, please.
100%.
I don't think I've ever told you, Paul. We were friendly. We were good friends for a little while, and I was in the middle of all my shows out here, and he was Joe Papp in New York. And he said one day, he said, you know what would be great? Why don't we do a series of American plays? I will pick the plays. You do one in California. I'll do one in New York. We each have 2 weeks to do them. We'll do a series of... I said, God, that's a great idea. We'll do, like Playhouse 90, live.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a terrific idea. So we made appointments to talk to the networks. We talked to two networks. The third one, I can't remember any longer why. It didn't make sense to go there. But we went to two of the networks. I think it was NBC and ABC. And NBC, and I don't remember in which order, but NBC said, you know, things are going well with the number one network. It's a really interesting idea. We don't need it. You ought to go to ABC. So we went to ABC, who needed it. And ABC said, you know, it's really a terrific idea, but we really need something we know can work, can catch, can, you know, and this is too heady or scholarly. So that was that. That's my joke.
And it never happened?
It never happened. It never happened. But I'll never forget that one network needed it, but it was too.
Right.
And the other work.
Was it kind of like a Playhouse 90 pitch?
It was a Playhouse 90. Yes, it was, we'll do an American play. Oh, okay. Like Playhouse, just the way Playhouse 90
We need
did.
That now.
But
that
it was,
would be
it,
great
was
now.
It was so many years after Playhouse 90.
How did you stay? Albert Snow, how those during those 2 years, so they came to see the other guy. They see you. You obviously went in and met Stone. You must have made quite an impression, because to hold the role for you and actually upgrade you over the 2 years.
The upgrade is that I was a third guy on the. I was Tom Berenger's radio man. And then 2 years later, he offered me Sergeant O'Neill.
Yeah.
And that was a big deal.
Well, a very big deal.
A really big deal.
So now tell us about, I was mentioning to Norman your story about helping him audition people. And when a guy walks in, he's just got it. You know, Norman tells about Carol O'Connor coming in.
So
just...
right after Platoon, Oliver asked me to do Wall Street with him. And then while we were shooting Wall Street, I was back at the Public. I was with Joe, Mr. Papp, doing talk radio. I did talk radio with Eric Bogosian for almost 2 years. I originated the play and just ran it. And so for about 3 weeks there, I had the New York actor's dream of being in a hit off-Broadway play at night and doing Wall Street, which we shot right down by the Woolworth Building, during the day.
Mm.
And I had a hard out, which Oliver never paid any attention to, so I could make Equity half hour.
Right.
And I came later and later every night, and he largely didn't care.
Right.
and so I'm getting, you know, the actors are at places in my wardrobe, and I'm like, no, because I inherited John Turturro's work ethic, and I was just like, no. Get out of my goddamn wardrobe. I'm going on.
Yeah.
So then Oliver would subsequently do talk radio, and conventional wisdom is, if you were in the play, we're going to star fuck your part, and we're going to get a bigger name.
Mm.
But he let me do the movie. And so then we did three movies back to back to back. And then when he was going to do The Doors, he said, will you come in and read actors? Because he knows I love actors. And he had a lot of really very demanding things for the actors in The Doors, which I was not in. And so I noticed during this time, and I'd already produced now two independent films by now, that when actors come in, especially for Oliver, they come in one of two ways, and I'm sure for you as well. But for real powerhouses, actors seem to come in two ways. One, we come in Pigpen, and that's most of the time. And Pigpen is a character in Peanuts or Charlie Brown, where there's this cloud of dust that precedes and follows this character everywhere. And cosmically, in my scenario, it's just this thing that we bring in, actors bring in, to subvert ourselves, which is completely counterintuitive, but that's what we do because we're so scared. And we do anything we can do to not get the gig. And I know that sounds counterintuitive, but we do it. Mm. And this Pigpen dust starts to precede you. And you're coming in to meet Oliver, and you're scared to death. And the first thing you say is, I didn't get the sides, which for the uninformed are the audition scene are called sides. I didn't get the sides, and my aunt died in Philadelphia last night, so I had to go to the wake. And so I don't know the material. Yeah. You just lost Oliver. You're out. You're out. Mm. He's trying to cast the movie. And I'd watch them just take a metaphorical weapon and shoot themselves right in the foot. Mm. And the opposite of that, of Pigpen, is Elvis dust. And Elvis dust is when actors come in and for whatever reason, you can't bottle it. If you do, it comes off as arrogance, which is there's nothing more abrasive to most filmmakers because they're scared to death. They don't know what they're doing, especially young filmmakers. Everything is just a no. And so if you give them a reason to double down on the no, you've saved them making a decision. So if you try to bottle Elvis dust, it comes off as abrasiveness. Mm. But what it is some combination of self-esteem, being in the right place at the right time, doing a shitload of homework, and coming in and just knocking the fucking cover off the ball. Mm. Now, you may or may not get the role, but sometimes people would leave, and Oliver would be like, oh, the part's written for a Puerto Rican, but we should fucking slate that person in. We should fucking slate. That's a superstar. And I'd watch this, and it happened to me on – I did the movie Seven, and Arnold Copelson brought me in with David Fincher, and I had Elvis dust all over me. I don't know why. But I wasn't – the role of the head of the SWAT team was written for a Latin man, and I had Elvis dust on me. Fincher rewrote it, and he put me in.
What did you sound like?
Fincher?
No, as the character.
Everything was right in here. It was very just staccato and really forced, and we're going to get this done.
You feel it. You feel it.
You can feel Elvis
dust. When you, it's like shooting a swish when it's all net.
You can feel Elvis dust.
You're coming off yourself.
You may not get the gig, but you know when you have Elvis dust.
So it's got to be
Elvis dust means you know you got it. It's a lock.
You're just giving off that Elvis dust.
It's just, and the reason I called it Elvis dust is when people come in with Elvis dust on them, all the filmmaker wants to do and everyone in the room is wants to get some of it on them. Whatever you have when you walked in, we just, whatever the fuck that is, we're like, let's get that
Elvis
dust. Let's get that in the frame.
I love that analogy.
And there's Pigpen and Elvis dust. And it may not work that way with first-time directors or dilettantes, but it damn sure works that way with Oliver. People get themselves so worked up into a panic, the storytellers, the actors who come in, that 9 times out of 10 they subvert themselves. And Oliver made everybody read for The Doors. I read actors for JFK, and I read actors for talk radio. And so I saw a large number of actors come in, and I want you to do great. I'm going to make this really easy for you because I love actors. And if you stumble or something, I'm gonna circle back and get it for you. And so you want me is reading with you when you come in to audition.
Yeah.
And I just could watch them. And we subvert ourselves. Why?
Yeah, I've felt myself do both. And then you go back over it. I've heard somebody say once you give 3 auditions when you audition. Every audition is 3 auditions. The audition you're going to give, the audition you actually give, and the audition you should have given. You know,
I buy that.
Those are sort of the Pigpen days. You know, I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. And I don't know why some you go, oh, man, was that great. I mean, that was just a great experience. Then when you get the gig, of course, that's the home run.
But, I know, but it has to be based on the former. It has to be based on did you hit a stand-up double? That's
well, it
all
is,
that matters.
Did you prepare work? The work.
Well, you that know, has to be assumed.
That has to be assumed. So you've got the work. And is it a hormonal thing? Is it like with a female? You know, is it a sort of a group hormonal thing, Norman?
The question I have that if you hit the double that you aim to hit, and you feel great about it, and you don't get the gig. Do you walk out feeling good?
You have to chalk that up as a win. It's essential.
But do you?
Yes.
Yeah. I came to that. I didn't always. There was a time we got, what the fuck? But then I like acting. I love acting. And I once heard Mick Jagger say, someone asked him, I want to be a singer. And what they meant was, I want to be Mick Jagger. But what he heard, what he said, you want to be a singer? Sing. You know, so somewhere it occurred to me, that I love acting. So if I go in a room and the producers are engaged and the director's engaged and we hit the ball back and forth and it's one of those days and I walk out there feeling great.
You got Elvis dust all over you.
It's a win.
It has to be.
It's got to be a win because I just got to act. It just went well, you know. And if I get the gig,
now it's now a year and a half later or 10 months later, you see the film and the role played by an actor that you. Auditioned for and well, felt great but didn't get it.
I have a strong feeling about that, but I want to let our guest take that one first, Johnny C.
I think a lot of times you were not cast for a specific reason because their vision, like Oliver, I'll go back to Oliver. Oliver's films aren't collaborations. They're Oliver's films. And he has like a Kentucky Derby thoroughbred. Artistically, he wears these blinders. And if you can, and it's a narrow creative frequency. And if you can fit into this frequency, it's nirvana. Mm. If you want to function out here, that's when people have their nightmare stories about Oliver.
Right.
Because it's his film. He's thought about it. He wrote it.
Yeah.
He stay in here. And so I think that to some degree, hopefully most filmmakers or TV people have some vision that they want that character to fit into. And if you take a big giant home run swing at it in the audition and it wasn't really where we were going and you the director don't even have the tools to redirect that actor somewhere, you dodged a bullet because this person, man or woman, can't, a lot of them can't communicate. I know that sounds insane.
Here's what I don't understand about Oliver. If you have him write as you just described him, even if you wrote the script, I wrote All in the Family. I wrote Archie Bunker. I don't know what I had in mind. I knew what was on the script, but I didn't know the look and the sound of that person at all. And I interviewed in New York maybe 30 people. And I didn't find Archie Bunker, and I came to California, and the first guy that walked in happened to be Carol O'Connor. And he wasn't off the first page before I knew I had Archie Bunker. But I never imagined a Carol O'Connor as Archie Bunker. This has to be true of Oliver Stone, too.
Of course.
So I mean, he has to have room for somebody coming in and... Now he knows what the hell he wants.
He couldn't find the Willem Dafoe character, who is a Native American Indian, in the script, and it's a soldier friend of his during his two tours in Southeast Asia. There was a Native American, and he was glorious and all these things that Willem Dafoe would end up being, playing the role of Elias. But he read every single Native American on the planet and couldn't find him, to your point. And so finally he wound up with Willem, but that,
because Dafoe walked in the room, auditioned, and crushed it.
Yes, but that role is very specifically, and it's lost in the film. But that is a Native American stud.
Yeah,
and Willem is much more graceful and beautiful and elegant, and not what's written in the script.
So sort
point,
of the
Norman.
Same thing. So yeah. Sort of the same vibe. So he leaves himself open to that.
Sometimes,
but I would say those days
more in casting than on the set.
Well, yeah, but yes, by the time you're there, but of course that would have been your same with Archie, right? Once you're there, now you know, you got your tools to work with.
Yes. You know, and now you're telling him how to be more him.
Yeah.
You know what was so fabulous? I got You won't remember this because it was ever so briefly, but we're in the second season of a show called Stan Against Evil, which is this.
And that's your current show, which is on what network?
On IFC, and it's back on November 1st.
Great.
And the first year, because I'm kind of obsessed with the Archie archetype, and having spent some time in your book, on reading your book and devouring the elevator scene with Archie and the whole waiting for the premiere night when they wanted you to get rid of a word or two, and it was a brinksmanship to the last second. And I remember coming to you at a mutual friend of ours' house and telling you that I based this one component of this character, Stan, on Archie. And it was that we can only reconcile him as an equal opportunity offender if it's based, if there's some other thing that there where the ballast is. And for me, it's his wife, who in the first episode, we find out, just died. And so his obsession with her loss is what floats him. And it gives him any sense of reconciliation is in his wife. And I attached to that hard. And I'm one of the producers of the show. And so while I'm cutting it, I was constantly cutting those tones and those sensibilities back in. And then you told me this story at our friend's house about Edith, either in real life or in just the context of the show. There was a character who Archie kisses, and then we find out a man who, and then we find out either, I couldn't get this right in the story, but either the actor or the character passed. And Edith goes into a spiral. And if I have the story right, you interviewed all these psychologists at UCLA. And will you recount that for me and then tell me what happened?
Well,
because you had to pull her out of her tailspin.
This transsexual is murdered for being who she was. And Edith can't believe in a guy. She loses her faith. I wanted to see what would happen, what would cause Edith to lose her faith in God. That caused her to lose her faith in God. We had that idea, the writers sitting around the table, and we could see how she'd lose her faith. But for weeks, we couldn't do the first idea because we couldn't deal with an Edith who didn't have faith, so she had to regain it in the next episode. We couldn't figure out how. And it took us weeks. And in that course of those weeks, I did bring in a couple of psychologists from UCLA, USC, and so forth. And, I mean, deep into our search, somebody asked a simple question. By the way, when Edith loses her faith, what happens to Archie?
Mm-hmm.
And we had it. Archie goes to pieces because he's so much of him dependent on her strength. And her strength came from her faith. So
isn't that fantastic?
Yeah, great. Fantastic. Yeah.
She can't circle the drain because of Archie.
Yeah.
Because Archie will fall apart. He is falling apart. He told me the story, and the guy who created Stan Against Evil is a guy named Dana Gould, who's a huge fan of yours, and he was one of the big writers in the Simpsons writing room for about 12 years, and this was the show he always wanted to do. And so we were having a Norman Lear love fest one day. We shoot it down in Atlanta. And I told him, I recounted best I could the story you just told me. And it just felt like it validated everything that we were hanging on to so much with the network. Because they just want, it's the high concept on Stand Against Evil is it's Archie Bunker fighting witches. And got the laugh.
I like that pitch. Sells itself.
And so, and it's the guy who, and my first season arc that I gave to myself just in my brain, my uber objective was always be getting back to your chair. Anytime you're not in your chair, Stan has this reclining Barca lounger. Anytime Stan's not in the chair, he's in the wrong place doing the wrong thing.
Oh, God, that's so good.
And it was so clean. And it just, it got us through the first season that any time I'm not in that chair, if I'm fighting some goddamn witch with a baseball bat, get in the chair. You have no business fighting a witch. That's and those sensibilities kept it right on.
And you're in the first season now?
No, second season.
Second season.
November 1st.
And you shoot in Atlanta?
Yeah, we shot it in June and July in Atlanta. And then we're chopping it and sweetening the music and the effects. And
did you say
Atlanta? No, it was
Atlanta
flub.
Is that
you shot 13 or how many?
No, the new normal is 8.
The new normal is 8.
8.
8 and 8 weeks?
8 in 4 weeks and 4 days.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
So we do all this cross-boarding, which is, I don't know if you have to do that yet. But
I don't know. I've not heard the expression, cross-boarding.
It's if we're in...
Wear women's clothes?
If we're in a location, we shoot out whatever's in that location in the 8 episodes.
Ah,
and
wow.
So I have all the actors rehearse it like a play. And so all 8 episodes. So you have to come and be able to do the first scene in the sound studio in episode 1, and then at the final, at the end of the episode 8, if we come back here to get rid of the bomb,
yeah,
we're shooting that this afternoon.
Yeah.
And it's absurd. But wow, that's what we get to do. So the trade-off is they give us almost complete creative control, but the budget is minuscule.
I've done that kind of thing. Independent filmmaking back in New York, do sort of, you know, shoot like that, right?
Yeah, well, that's the way we shot Platoon. Platoon, we'd do 40 setups a day. I know that sounds like fiction, but we would.
Wow. How long were you down there?
The Philippines, 4 months.
Ooh, man.
He shot Platoon, and this is absurd, but he shot it as in order. So as you died, as your character died, you left. And so it was great.
Wow, yeah.
That's impossible to do, but that's what he did.
And then, so then...
impossible to do from a business standpoint.
Yes.
Yeah. Hey, tell us about...
Oliver Stone.
So then from that, Scrubs, you didn't stop working for out of school, right? I mean, you...
Yeah, for a little while there, I was doing about 4 films a year.
Yeah, that means... great.
When you walked in, you said something when we first started talking about stress. What, and I'm reminded of it by talking about the amount of work, what stress were you facing when you walked in? What's happening in your life right now that's stressful?
The most stressful thing I do is advocate for the special needs community, for the Down. My son Max is 20, and he was born with Down syndrome. And so, and he's doing great, and he just got a job at Starbucks, which is unimaginable that has realized fruition. And I guess since Max is largely in good shape, I've gotten to focus on our larger community and kind of the human rights issues of them being the most underserved minority in the country and a group that populates every race, creed, religion on the planet, are people with Down syndrome. And
what percentage does that represent of the population, Down syndrome?
I don't know. But it's a large, underserved population.
It
yes. It's diminishing because as these prenatal tests come out and you can find out what color your teeth, your kid's teeth are going to be, you can abort the birth and earlier and earlier. And so it's a diminishing population, but we do have hundreds of thousands of young kids and adults. Now, since your life expectancy, if you're born with Down syndrome, is 60, in 1968 it was 25, and so our population is living longer, and that's a double-edged sword because as you live longer, there are two dirty little secrets that you come across: is you will have no age-appropriate friends, that you just won't, and you will be diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and that's been interesting for us from a research standpoint because people who are born with Down syndrome do not get hard, fatty tumors. We get leukemia, but we don't get hard, fatty tumors. But we're guaranteed to get Alzheimer's. And there's an epidemic of Alzheimer's coming for our generation. And there's no infrastructure in place. There's nothing for it. Nobody knows what it is except for plaque in the brain. So what? Right. Nobody has any idea what it is. And the statistics on what's going to happen with Alzheimer's with our group is staggering. So
when you talk about Alzheimer's, you're not talking about it related to Down syndrome, just Alzheimer's.
Only that everybody with Alzheimer's, with Down syndrome, if you live long enough, you will be diagnosed with conditions consistent with Alzheimer's, and you will be diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
Okay, and then you... Alongside that, you're saying, in your generation,
these two men are
considerably younger than I am. In your generation, Alzheimer's is growing.
It's a tidal wave.
is a title.
We mean art, like not non-Down syndrome.
Yes. Or in
the... Yeah, just generally.
Really?
Yes.
What
and
did
so
you
what's
say
been,
again?
What's no. been really interesting is that that's now finally made the Down syndrome community relevant in a scientific research dollars way. Mm-hmm. Because the dirty little secret with Down syndrome is, well, you should have had the abortion. And it's like, how dare you?
How dare you?
Have you actually heard that?
Oh, sure.
And no kidding.
Oh, God. It's brutal.
You mean somebody saying this to you who know,
no.
sees your son talks about...
Absolutely not. Oh, no. But in a fundraising capacity, you don't make your problem our problem. You should. Right. You had an option. You didn't exercise it. Go with God.
Because I don't know a lot about it. Your son just got a job at Starbucks. I love hearing that. What's going to be different about him as a result of his having Down syndrome as he works at Starbucks?
He has language difficulties, and he has fine motor skill difficulties, and Max is most likely double diagnosed somewhere on the spectrum of autism, which is not unusual with people with Down syndrome. And so he has a lot of different challenges that present in social circumstances that can be awkward. Mm-hmm. But he has a shadow at Starbucks, and he's kind of a utility infielder. And so he restacks the sandwiches. He'll do whatever they ask him to do. And he works there down in Santa Monica for about an hour and a half on Monday.
Can he make a double macchiato and do that kind of thing?
No.
No.
That ship sailed.
Yeah.
But he greets and he...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And he's very social. And the funniest thing is we spent thousands and thousands of dollars on his language over the years and trying to generate language. And at Starbucks, he only speaks Spanish.
You're kidding.
Hola, señor. Me llamo Maxo. I'm like, what? When the fuck did you start speaking Spanish?
Did Max just decide that on his own?
Yes.
That's fantastic.
I love that.
That's the best.
So he mostly speaks Latin to people down at Starbucks.
I wonder what on him there.
He learned to speak Spanish because there was no pressure to do so.
I buy that.
Mm. Yeah.
He picked it up that way.
And so I don't know if that presents as stress. And I was being a bit of a wise guy when I said that to Paul, but I would say advocating for people who can't advocate for themselves is something that kind of consumes me. Mm-hmm. And it's not a source of stress as much as a necessity. I just can't stop.
And the buddy walks.
Well, good
and
for them.
A lot of great work on that. And tell us also about the, you know, fighting against the R word. And how connecting it to the N-word and to the other words that we no longer, you know, that are awful words, you know.
Well, I was at the World Winter Games for the Special Olympics about 8 years ago now in Boise, Idaho. And a component of all World Games at the Special Olympics is a youth leadership conference where about 180, 200 kids or English-speaking kids from around the planet go into an auditorium. In this state, it was at Boise State University. And they self-advocate. I didn't even know what a self-advocate was. And they start tabling topics that are concerning them and that they'd like to talk about. And to a person, the words retard and retarded, as they were directed towards them in the common language around the planet, they were just like, that's just bullshit. It sucks. Mm-hmm. And so between Tim Shriver and a couple of us and some of the self-advocates, we crafted this campaign called Spread the Word to End the Word. And it was mostly a viral campaign that you sign up for. And it wasn't spawned from another celebrity telling me how to fucking talk. It was the self-advocates going like, God damn, I sure like not to be called a retard again. Yeah. Because retard is to the special needs community as the N-word is to the African-American community. Mm. And any other pejorative words you can think of that disparage any group and make them less than. Mm. And so we came up with the Spread the Word to End the Word campaign. And then I've kind of taken it and put it on steroids and just made the R-word campaign my raison d'etre. I just it's very clear to me that it's a source of bullying, and I'm not big on bullies.
Yeah, and I've come to learn I've learned a lot from you about that. If it's not a word I was unfamiliar with, you know. But I think it's another thing where I didn't have anyone Down syndrome in
Me
my
neither.
Life.
Me neither.
So it's not telling somebody how to talk. It's like, hey, making people aware. Then it's like, oh, wow. You know, and now I hear it as when I see it in writing on television or something, as you said, it's the lazy man's way to
Well, it's never a compliment.
It's never a compliment. And they try and use it in comedy.
And it's a lazy joke.
It's a lazy joke, you know. And it's about time that it's seen as for what it is, which is on par with the N-word and all this
stuff. Right. But it disparages that population, and it perpetuates this stigma about a group that never did anything to anybody. In fact, it's not in their genetic makeup to do anything to anybody. They're not a threat. And the flip side of that is because they're not a threat, they're a perfect soft target for bullying.
Mm.
And that drives me fucking insane.
Yeah. 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 That's good work, man. Maxie. Now, what else? So, Stan, and you got another movie coming out, don't you?
Yeah, there's one out right now with me and Danny Glover called The Good Catholic that opened up last week.
The Good Catholic?
Yes.
I don't know about that.
Danny Glover and I went to Bloomington, Indiana, to Indiana University.
Uh-huh.
And it was one of those 18-day low-budget independents where you go and you work 3 6-day weeks, which is now the common structure on low-budget independents. I guess SAG lets people work 6-day weeks for a finite period of time.
Yeah.
And you go for 18 days and you shoot.
Who directed that? Who's
A young kid who wrote it named Paul Schulberg. He did a great job. It's about a priest who has a crisis of faith when he takes a confession one night and a girl says she's dying. And then she comes out of the confessional. She's beautiful. And he starts to try to reconcile his faith with his love. And the writer-director's father was a priest who fell in love with a nun, and the church can't really accommodate their employees marrying each other.
No, it's not. They poo-poo on that.
He took that life experience. They would then get married and have Paul, and he turned the priest into somebody who was with the priest called him civilians. The priest fell in love with a civilian, and Danny Glover plays this very, very pragmatic, old-school, Old Testament priest, and I play the kind of this Jesuit kind of injured modern priest, much more progressive. God is love, love is God, and I just want to empower this kid. And it becomes a three-way tug of war for this kid between the girl, Danny, and me, all pulling for this young priest.
Oh, great. What's it called?
The Good Catholic.
The Good Catholic.
Danny. I work with Danny. We did a little thing called Lethal Weapon 3.
Oh, that a boy.
Yeah.
Our whole budget on The Good Catholic didn't equal your craft services budget.
Right. Isn't that amazing? I look at doing these big giant movies like Face Off. I remember Face Off. We're down at base camp and there was just this giant clump of black wrap, right? Just black wrap, for those who don't know, is something they wrap on grip stands. It's used for lighting and to, you know, and it comes in a roll. And I had just made my first film that I wrote and directed, which we made for about $18, right? And our budget allowed for one roll of black wrap. I was having the grips take it off the grip stands, fold it up nicely because we were using it again. And I'll never forget walking from base camp to set and just seeing on the side of the road downtown, there was a giant roll of black wrap. And I went, excuse me, who left? What is it? Fold that up. Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And the same budget on Stan. Stan is... We have a hard time flying actors in from Los Angeles or New York to play, you know, numbers 5, 6, and 7 on the call sheet because we won't travel or house actors on our budget. So you got to pluck from a profoundly overrated talent pool in Atlanta of actors to play these juicy roles. And it makes you just want to circle the wagons a little tighter and distribute to the ensemble proper, not to any visitors.
But I guess the upside is you get to make your show.
That is the upside.
Because there's so many outlets now, right? And there's all these. Now your IFC.
What is the outlet for the IFC?
Yes.
Yeah. So you get to make the show. The downside is you're not flying people in. And the SAG rules is like first class and all that other stuff, isn't it?
It's not. And housing the actors and giving them per diem. And I'm one of the producers on it. And it's not. It's not in the budget.
Right, yeah.
It's not there.
Yeah.
And I love putting my friends, maybe you were this way, Norman, I don't know. I love putting my friends in shows that I'm producing. Like, nothing makes me happier.
Yeah, no, I love that. When you have a good idea and a friend's a Yeah.
Yes.
But you wouldn't sacrifice the role for the friend.
I'm not suggesting that.
Yeah, no, I know.
If things meet up, and why wouldn't you bring Paul down to Atlanta?
Yeah.
Because there's no money.
I was waiting for that. You know, I'd drive.
Stay tuned. No, stay tuned.
Drive down. I got a Prius.
Stay tuned.
Well, you, Norman, you're discovered a lot of the people that you worked with from theater, correct? Sherman
yes.
Helmsley, people
Sherman,
like this?
Yes. Conrad Bain and...
Because you saw everything in New York.
I've got to remember his name. He was the greatest agent in New York. Rollins. Jack Rollins.
That predates us. Rollins.
He was Woody Allen's original. Mike Nicholson, Elaine May's
Oh, he got a
original.
Bunch of producer's credit on Woody's movies.
All those,
of course.
And he was a great, great guy. And he used to take me off Broadway. I remember going to Brooklyn or the Bronx and seeing a play in a living room.
Wow.
And falling in love with an actor there. Oh, my God. We used to go to every night every other night we used to go to an off Broadway something. So all of the talent, what's his face?
That guy.
Who runs Universal?
Ron Meyer?
Ronnie Meyer. Ronnie Meyer and two other agents whose name disgraced himself or who,
Mike Ovitz.
Mike Ovitz, who owned Los Angeles, if not Los Angeles, Hollywood. Anyway, the three of them used to come, they have told me, they used to come to the rehearsals of All in the Family because I was bringing in New York actors and they had just left William Morris to start their own agency, which became the biggest agency in the world. Because they knew these New York actors didn't have representation out here.
Oh, that's interesting.
So they would pick them off.
So they would pick off the Sally...
Sally Struthers
and Rob Reiners and whatnot. And that's how they began.
That's great. That's fantastic.
I always loved hearing that.
So, Johnny C., what's going on? What's in the future?
Now you go to Comic-Con, and now because, as you guys were suggesting, the landscape of outlets and TV is so dense.
Yeah.
You have to find a way to make Stand Against Evil stand out a little bit. So, Comic-Con, which is – do you know what Comic-Con is?
Yes.
So we'll go to New York on the 4th and do that, do some big auditorium. And then you do all the talk shows, and you run for office and try to –
Run for office.
Yeah, you got to try to pump it up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And do you do the social media thing? Do you find that that's a...
Yes, I think Twitter is useful for that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I don't get Facebook. It's confusing to me.
Right.
And so I just do I tweet out a lot.
Well, you're also on All of the Above with Norman Lear on the Podcast One Network.
Oh, my God. Yeah. All of the Above. That's what we're doing here.
Yeah. Norman Lear, who, by the way, Norman Lear, he's very famous. He was on the Emmys on Sunday. Good job on the Emmys, I'm going to tell you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
How many of those have you won?
I presented four. Only four.
I find that hard to believe.
But the show's won dozens. I don't know.
Well, that's what I mean.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I don't know. I won four specifically.
100.
But the amazing thing about Carol Burnett and I adore her. 2 days before we were to do this, I turn on the television set. I don't remember what I was looking for, but boom, on some channel, I don't know which what it was, there's Carol Burnett sitting in a simple stool talking about a sketch, and suddenly there's a sketch from the old Carol Burnett show. Hmm. That's what this 40 or more minutes that I watched was happening. Sketch after sketch from the old Carol Burnett show. And I laughed. I can't overstate how funny I thought. Harvey Korman
and Tim Conway.
Oh. And Tim Conway and a couple of sketches.
They were money.
Unbelievable.
And it was so easy for me to say to her, laughing at you has added time to my life.
Did you improv that? Huh? Was that just, did you add that line in there?
Yeah, I wasn't in the our little script.
Yeah.
It was but I had to say that I was so overcome with how much I laughed. Yeah. If you remember just that dental sketch. The two of them.
Yeah.
Harvey Korman with a bad toothache and Tim Conway, the dentist.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I thought that on, when we were growing up, I thought that ensemble of those three or four, Vicki Lawrence being the fourth.
Yeah.
And Jonathan Winters, for some reason.
I love Jonathan Winters.
Oh, my God, he was glorious.
It just destroyed me.
Yeah.
As a little boy.
Yeah. Yeah, just great. You know what else I love is all the impersonators, you know, the Rich Littles and Frank Gorshins and all those guys.
But Frank Gorshin always had a little edge to him, and you couldn't tell if he was going to just punch the lens or something.
Well, Norm and I were talking the other day about variety could use to come back, right? There's room for a variety show somewhere.
Oh, my God.
But isn't that what those talent contests are?
I think with the personality at the, you know, the Cal Burnett show was a comedy show, of course, but it also had that vibe.
It was a review.
You know, and all those things that we talked about, Dwight Hemian did and all those guys, you know, there's room for that now. A modern version. How could you do a modern version of that? But anyway, we're going to watch Stand Against Evil on IFC. Johnny C. McGinley.
This was a great time together. Thank you so much for this. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me in.
John C. McGinley, Paul Hipp. This has been All of the Above with Norman Lear. And I remember him well because I sleep with him every night, wake up with him every morning, and say goodnight from All of the Above every week.
Goodnight, All of the Above.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Norman Lear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Hipp.
And life is good, and space and time. Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine.